This is Peter Johnson introducing the Catholic Heritage Program, broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and stories from our Catholic past, and inspiration for our Catholic future. When Christ ordained the apostles as his first bishops, he made them fishers of men. Down through Christian history, the symbol of the fish has often been used as a sign for Christianity. One of the most famous of English bishops bore the surname Fisher. He was not only a great and holy bishop, but also a martyr. And today, many schools and churches in England are named after him. He was Saint John Fisher, martyred in the reign of King Henry VIII, and Joanna Beville now takes up his story.
Everyone, it seems, has heard of St. Thomas More, but far fewer people have heard of St. John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, whose name is linked with his. The two share a feast day, it's June the 22nd, and both were martyred at the Tower of London in the reign of King Henry VIII. But while St. Thomas More, Speaker of the House of Commons, author, family man, wit and public figure, has his place in popular culture, John Fisher does not. Perhaps the filmmakers have a lot to do with it. Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons, became world famous when it was turned into a film starring Paul Scofield. Who could fail to remember that dramatic trial scene at Westminster, or the earlier rural scenes of family life and a royal visit down the river at Chelsea? Meanwhile, St. John Fisher's life has so far passed unrecorded by Hollywood, and perhaps that's a pity, because it's a remarkable story, and one that would make a fairly powerful film. He was born in 1469 at Beverley in North Yorkshire, in the north of England, and named after the patron saint of that city, St. John of Beverley. His father was a mercer, that's a tradesman in silks and velvets, a native Yorkshireman. Young John was educated at Cambridge University, at Michaelhouse, and thus designed for the priesthood from an early age. At that time, boys went up to Cambridge while still in their early teens, and so John Fisher's most formative years were spent there, and he was to retain a lifelong affection for the university. He went on to become master of the college, and in 1501 was appointed vice-chancellor of the university. A friend and mentor of Lady Margaret Beaufort, who endowed the university with several scholarships, he himself played a major part in the university's renewal during his years as vice-chancellor. These were years of change and debate across Europe. The old certainties were fading as new discoveries were made in geography. Speculation was rife about unexplored territories beyond the seas, and the medieval world was giving way to that of the Renaissance. Nowhere was the debate more ferocious than when it touched on abuses and anomalies within the Catholic Church itself. All thinking people knew that the time was ripe for renewal. Men had been ordained as priests who were ignorant of many aspects of the faith. No systematic training for them was provided. Not infrequently, they were now presented by members of their congregations with complex questions which they couldn't answer, touching on aspects of faith and morals or doctrinal teachings which they had not felt it necessary to explore, or about which they had never been adequately taught. John Fisher lived a personally austere life, while enriching the university's libraries and schools, making good use of all the gifts and donations. He was known as a man of prayer and of real devotion to God, as well as one of learning, who delighted in books, in reading, and in scholarly discussions. He took a real and personal interest in the young men studying at the university, and saw it as a place of spiritual, moral, and intellectual formation. Small wonder, then, that this pearl of the university attracted attention on the wider national scene. In 1504, he was appointed Bishop of Rochester. This was an important diocese. Rochester is a town on the River Medway in Kent, in the south of England, just across the Channel from France. It was an important place with good transport links, and therefore a sense of bustle and prosperity. Today it forms part of the Catholic Diocese of Southwark. Its old cathedral, which has so many links with John Fisher, still stands. As Bishop of Rochester, John Fisher was obliged to forego the many pleasant hours he'd spent in his library or talking with students on academic subjects, enjoying the educational work that he so loved. He now became a pastoral bishop, and while the academic work was not neglected, many hours of work with the poor, sick, and needy were added to his daily round. He also worked hard with his priests to improve their education, reform their moral lives, and create a Catholic priesthood worthy of its holy calling. This was perhaps his greatest achievement at the pastoral level. From being ignorant and sometimes lazy, the priests were transformed. They were given what today we'd perhaps call in-service training, with study days and times of prayer together with their bishop, who instructed them in matters of which they were ignorant, expecting a serious commitment to study and a real love of the Church and a zeal to impart the healing graces of her sacraments. Bishop Fisher also became known as a father to the poor. As bishop, he would personally visit the sickbeds of some of the humblest of his flock, and we have a touching description of some of these scenes from his chaplain, who went with him. In those days, the very humblest folk would live in poor huts without even the luxury of a chimney, so that a fire smoked on the floor in one corner, and the room was acrid with its smoke and fumes. On a dirty bed, enduring illness without the help of a nurse or decent food, a dying man would receive at least the consolations of the Church, not with a fleeting visit, but with real pastoral care. Bishop Fisher would, of course, bring some nourishment, perhaps food or a warm drink, but above all, companionship and the loving care of the last sacraments. He would hear a man's confession, talk with him, pray with him, and anoint him, and then stay with him, often sitting for hours to console and be a source of help and encouragement, as the final hours ebbed past. Then, without having taken any rest himself, he would travel on, perhaps to make another such visit, perhaps to a distant parish where he was celebrating Mass or administering confirmation. His chaplain noted how Fisher never sought comfort, making do with meagre food and enduring damp and cold. When finally at home in the bishop's palace, he was content with a cold, unheated room in a building which was in a very poor state of repair, with the sole exception of its library, which was kept in good condition because of the books, which were for the use of his priests and students. Fisher wore simple clothing beneath the vestments or other official robes. He went without hot food or other modest comforts, denying himself sleep and always putting himself at the service of others. He never, however busy his day, neglected any hour of prayer. He was always available for those in need. He was loved for this, and set a tone of service and priesthood which gradually transformed the diocese. Of course, he became known at court. King Henry VIII wanted precisely this sort of man to be in charge of a major city in the kingdom. Such a man was a jewel for the whole nation, learned, humble, sincere, capable, and hard-working. Fisher was already known in royal circles through his Cambridge connections. He had known the king and his queen Catherine for years. He had grieved with them over the loss of their babies in infancy, and had seen their daughter, Princess Mary, grow from a toddler to a gifted and intelligent young girl. With the rest of the court, he had seen Henry at his best, intelligent, witty, strong and amusing, a monarch with a presence which filled any room. When Henry fell in love with Anne Boleyn, banished Catherine, and announced his intention of having his marriage declared null, the initial reaction of many must have been to wait and see. Perhaps the king would tire of this new young woman. She was not the first to have been his mistress. One thing gradually became clear. The marriage to Catherine was certainly valid. This had been a true marriage, and could not be declared null merely because one party wished it so. It was certainly the case that Catherine had first been married to Henry's older brother, Arthur, a sickly young man who had died less than a year later. But the correct dispensation had been obtained to free Henry to marry Catherine as his brother's widow, even though it was known that such a dispensation was not strictly necessary, as the marriage between Arthur and Catherine had not been consummated. Catherine was Henry's true wife and true queen, but Henry was a powerful monarch. He could, and did, take charge of matters himself. He announced the formation of an English tribunal, which, ignoring the findings of Rome, called witnesses and announced its own ruling that Henry was free to marry Anne Boleyn. Catherine carried herself with so much dignity in front of its tribunal that she won all hearts. Everyone was aware that she had won the moral victory. One of the great scenes of that age is that of her on her knees before the man she loved, knowing herself to be his true wife, who had borne him many children, though, as she tragically put it, it hath pleased God not to spare them. Her beauty had once captivated his heart, her training as a princess had never left her, and her deep religious faith sustained her always. It was not a scene which anyone who watched it would ever forget. Henry had his own plans, even while he must surely have been troubled in conscience. Marriage to Anne Boleyn became an urgent necessity once the fact of her pregnancy became certain. He steeled himself to go ahead with his plans, and stifled any voice of Catholic conscience. Opposition to him could spell doom, and started to do so. An oath of allegiance was required, which would effectively bind all who took it to two central truths: that Henry had lawfully married Anne Boleyn, and that he was head of the church in England. Henry created his own entity, a new state church. It was not in any real sense Protestant. Its forms and style were all familiar, Latin and chanting, feast days and fast days. You could pretend to yourself that nothing had changed. The years when the Mass was to be declared idolatrous and priests were to be banned from the kingdom were some way ahead. For Bishop Fisher, the issues were not that simple. We may, with the hindsight of history, see John Fisher and Thomas More as men who saw clearly when others were muddled, men who never wavered when everyone else did, who nobly held fast to what was true when others fudged. All that is so, but it wasn't so obvious at the time. Many hedged and muttered and found ways out. Bishops took the new oath and told themselves it was only a matter of form. Men privatized their ideas, men who were personally traditional and orthodox in their beliefs, in their loyalty to Rome, but who wanted a comfortable life and for things to go on at the personal level just as they'd done before. Fisher, who loved his people in Rochester, his priests who ministered to them, his books and his plans for the university, had much to lose. He didn't say no lightly when asked to give unconditional support to Henry. He didn't brightly decide to be a martyr. He took the decision knowing that it would cost him a great deal, but knowing that God would judge him as a bishop. He and Thomas More were the two who held fast to the truth. They knew that Christ has appointed just one head of the church on earth, the successor of St. Peter, and that this is a scriptural truth which no monarch can replace with an invention of his own. Thomas More was to write of John Fisher, "I reckon in this realm no man in wisdom, learning, and long-approved virtue, together, meet to be matched and compared with him." Fisher refused to take the oath. He upheld the validity of the marriage between Henry and Catherine. He upheld the teachings of the Catholic Church. In 1534, he was arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London. He was in poor health, and now he was ill-treated, given only rags to wear and inadequate food. He was not allowed books and was thus unable to do anything except pray, but he didn't lack friends. It was while he was in prison that the Pope in faraway Rome named him a cardinal. This infuriated Henry. Fisher was eventually brought to trial and charged with treason. His offence was that he had undermined the king's authority in the church. Found guilty, he was sentenced to death. As a bishop, and a much-loved one, he couldn't be hanged, drawn, and quartered in public. He was to be beheaded on Tower Hill. He was already so ill that he had to be brought to the place of execution on a wooden chair. He was peaceful and serene, reading the New Testament while waiting at the Tower Gateway, and finding consolation in St. John's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 3-5, at which the book had accidentally fallen open. It's the account of Christ's passion, where Judas comes forward with a group of soldiers to arrest him. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said to them, What seek ye? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And he answered, I am he. John Fisher commented, There's enough learning in that to last me to the end of my life. And he went forward in his turn, following his master, and met his death with the same courage and serenity. It was June the 22nd, 1535. So here we are in All Hallows by the Tower, and this is where John Fisher was buried. Tell me about that.
Well, as far as we know, he's buried in our porch area, which wasn't there at the time, it was part of the graveyard. There's no actual stone marker where he's buried, for obvious reasons, for fear of his body being moved and deconsecrated.
And so they would have just buried him here, because this was the nearest church.
It was the nearest church to the to Tower Hill.
And he was executed just a few yards away.
A few yards away, yeah. He's one of the few people to be executed in the tower.
And his body would have been brought here?
Would have been brought here, laid out, and then buried.
Do you get a lot of people coming here asking about John Fisher?
We certainly do. We certainly do. There will be, hopefully, September, October time. We're hoping to have a new triptych hanging put up, which is at the moment being painted.
This is an old church, isn't it? Now, when was the first church built on this site?
The first church was built in 675, which is Saxon. We have just the remaining archway for that, and in this archway we have Roman tiles, which they used from a villa that was on the site previous to that.
So this church was standing here on this site about 300 years before the Norman Conquest.
That's right, but it's 400 years, roughly 400 years older than the Tower of London.
You really look down on the tower as being quite new, don't you?
It is. That's the rubble.
John Fisher died because he was a true Catholic bishop. He died for loyalty to the successor of St. Peter, the Pope. He died in defence of lifelong marriage and in opposition to attempts to obtain an unjust annulment of a marriage in the Catholic Church. He died because he did his duty as a bishop and upheld the Catholic faith, up to and including the point of martyrdom. One of the gifts he left behind was this prayer for bishops, as relevant today as when it was written 400 years ago.
Lord, according to your promise that the gospel should be preached throughout the whole world, raise up men fit for such work. The apostles were but soft and yielding clay, till they were baked hard by the fire of the Holy Spirit. So, good Lord, do now in like manner again with thy church militant. Change and make the soft and slippery earth into hard stones. Set in thy church strong and mighty pillars that may suffer and endure great labours, watching, poverty, thirst, hunger, cold and heat, which shall also not fear the threatenings of princes, persecution, neither death, but always persuade and think with themselves to suffer with a good will, slanders, shame, and all kinds of torments for the glory and laud of thy holy name. By this manner, good Lord, the truth of thy gospel shall be preached throughout all the world. Therefore, merciful Lord, exercise thy mercy, show it indeed upon thy church.
Finding out about our Catholic heritage is something that can bring the generations together. It's a family journey. Joanna Bogle found this out when she went with her two nieces, Lucy and Monica, to Westminster Abbey recently.
If you really want to know about London's history, you have to visit Westminster Abbey. And not London's history alone, but the history of all of England. Because it's in this thousand-year abbey, founded by St. Edward the Confessor, our last Saxon king, before the Norman Conquest of 1066. It's in this abbey that most of our kings and queens have been crowned and anointed, and where a good many of them are buried. It's called Westminster because it's to the west of London, and a minster is where the monks lived, They lived and they farmed here on this land, marshy, lying low by the Thames River, curling its way out of London westwards. It's half term, and a golden, golden autumn day in England, and I'm here in London with my two nieces, Lucy and Monica, who are spending half term with me here in London. At the moment, we're having a cup of tea in Victoria Street, and we're looking forward to going to Westminster Abbey. So I'm going to ask the girls what they're looking forward to about seeing the Abbey. Over to you, Lucy.
Isn't Westminster where all our famous English writers were buried, like Dickens and Milton? Is that something to do with a place called Poets' Corner? I think I've heard of it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Poets' Corner is just that. It's a sort of corner of the Abbey. And it's where some of our most famous writers are either buried or have a commemorative plaque. So I suppose we'll probably find lots of their names there. I think it starts right away with Chaucer, who's the best known earliest writer that we've got. Well, we'll make a beeline for Poets' Corner when we're in the Abbey. And now, Monica, you're the one that's interested in kings and queens, aren't you?
Yes. I've heard that there are lots of kings and queens buried in Westminster Abbey, including some of the Tudors and the Stuarts.
Well, that's right, and we're going to go and find their tombs. And then as well as that, there are all sorts of, you know, statesmen and warriors and admirals and explorers. So we'll drink up our tea, girls, and here's to Westminster Abbey. Well, here we are at the Abbey, and these marvellous walls with the flying buttresses soaring up ahead of us, and the roar of an aeroplane overhead, and the chimes of Big Ben in the distance. We're right opposite Parliament, and it's just chiming 3 o'clock, and the sunlight's dappling on the lovely old grey walls of the Abbey, and the rather newer but still 150 years old walls of the Houses of Parliament opposite. There's 1,000 years of history in between these two buildings. And certainly the Abbey has so much to offer the visitor, and we've been really enjoying looking around. And we did find some kings and queens, didn't we, Monica? Which did we find?
We found lots of kings and queens. A few were Richard II, Henry VII, Elizabeth I, Mary Tudor, Henry V, and Mary, Queen of Scots.
And some of the tombs were very old and worn out and faded, and some of them were rather huge and impressive, especially some of those for kings, weren't they?
Yes.
And as well as that, didn't we find a real saint as well?
Edward the Confessor. His tomb is behind the high altar, and 6 pilgrims used to go and pray there and lay their hands on his shrine.
Well, sick people still do that, don't they, in places of pilgrimage like Lourdes?
Yes, our big brother went to Lourdes to help with the disabled, and there were holy processions and masses every day.
So St. Edward the Confessor is still there, his body is still there in the shrine, and he was the one that founded the Abbey before the Norman Conquest. Well, lots of people have been buried there since that time, and you did get to Poets' Corner, didn't you, Lucy?
Yes, we did. And I was very impressed by it. Actually, it was bigger than a corner. It was more like an area of the Abbey, really. And there were lots and lots of famous authors. And I found it rather satisfying to be able to stand with Chaucer on your right and Dickens on your left. But what was also satisfying, that there weren't just, you know, sort of adult authors, but there were authors like Lear and T.S. Eliot, who wrote funny poems that I read. There was a monument to Shakespeare, who of course isn't buried here, he's buried on Stratford-upon-Avon, and one to George Eliot, and I found out that her real name was Mary Ann Evans. There's a rather mingy, small monument to Jane Austen, which I was a bit disappointed in, because I think she's a marvellous writer. She's actually buried in Winchester. But I must say that the most interesting bit was when we found the monument of a poet, of a author called Caedmon. He was a cowherd a long time ago. He wrote lovely poetry, but unfortunately he was too shy to write most of it down. But there was an abbess at that time who was called St. Hilda of Whitby, who encouraged him to write it all down, and thanks to her we still have some of his lovely poetry.
So Westminster Abbey really was something rather special. And there were places you could light candles, weren't there, as well, and we could say a prayer there, and we prayed to Our Lady and to St. Peter, after whom the Abbey is dedicated.
And then finally, what did we find in that very moving, big grave just by the great door, surrounded by the red poppies?
We found the grave of the unknown warrior who was found on the battlefield after the Second World War.
That's right. Well, it was the First World War. That's right. And they didn't know who he was, and he represents all the other unknown warriors. And they brought him and buried him among the kings, because he was the unknown soldier who'd fought in the Great War. And he represents all the men for whom there isn't a proper grave. Well, it really was worth going to the Abbey, wasn't it?
Definitely.
Definitely. And we're going to remember this is the place where so much English Christian history has been written, and where our kings and queens have been crowned and anointed from the time of Saint Edward the Confessor. Edward the Confessor was the last of our Saxon kings and crucial in our Christian history. When he brought the Benedictine monks to Westminster, he couldn't have known that one day there would, after the Reformation and 400 years more after that, be a Benedictine who would become the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster. He's buried at Westminster Cathedral. He's Cardinal Hume, who died a few months ago, and he's buried at Westminster Cathedral at the other end of Victoria Street. I think we'll go and visit Westminster Cathedral before we go home, shall we?
Good idea.
We hope that you've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's V-A-N-D-I-V-E-R, Alabama, USA, 35176. Or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com.